The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This episode of Harvey Brownstone Interviews is brought to you by the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend Coffee, available at hollywoodblends.com. Everyone's saying it's the best coffee they've ever tasted. Why not give it a try and see for yourself?
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is a highly respected actor, writer, songwriter, producer, director, author, educator, and film company executive. The fact that he has show business in his blood comes as no surprise, given that he's the son of screen legend Stella Stevens. On the big screen, you've seen him in The Boys in Company C, which earned him a Golden Globe Award nomination for Best Male Newcomer. And he also received the Star of Tomorrow Award from the National Association of Theater Owners. He also appeared in Shampoo, The Fury, Death Hunt, The Seduction, Double Threat, Pop Star, Missionary Man, and many more. On TV, he appeared in dozens of shows and movies, including Once an Eagle, Topper, Code Red, Hollywood Wives, Hotel, Dallas, and many more. He's also written many screenplays and composed numerous songs for movies and TV shows. He's directed over a dozen feature films, including world premieres on HBO and Showtime, as well as multiple episodes of popular TV series. But beyond all of that, our guest is one of the most prolific and successful producers in Hollywood. He has co-founded and run numerous film production companies and is currently president and CEO of Andrew Stevens Entertainment and Stevens Entertainment Group. He's produced hundreds of enormously successful feature films, including The Whole Nine Yards, Angel Eyes, The Pledge, City by the Sea, The Big Kahuna, Green Dragon, Get Carter, The Marksman, Black Dawn, and dozens more. As an educator, he created a fully accredited Associate of Applied Arts college degree program in motion picture production, which formed the basis of an online certificate program called Foolproof Film School, based on his best-selling 2014 book entitled Foolproof Filmmaking: Make a Movie That Makes a Profit. His other books are Producing for Profit, A Practical Guide to Making Independent and Studio Films, and Screenwriting for Profit, Writing for the Global Marketplace. And if all of that weren't enough, our guest also serves on the board of directors of the International Film and Television Alliance, and until recently served as chairman of the Independent Producers Association. I'm delighted and honored to welcome Andrew Stevens to our show. Andrew, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Harvey. That was a very comprehensive introduction. Thank you.
I'm known for that. I want to start by paying tribute to your dear mom, Stella Stevens, whom we lost last year at the age of 84. She was a very popular actress and, by all accounts, a wonderful human being. You've written, produced, and directed a documentary called Stella Stevens, The Last Starlet. What inspired you to make that movie?
My mother had a long, many years struggle with cognitive decline, dementia, and then Alzheimer's. And my mother was tough. So she lasted quite a while when people thought it was the final stages, and she ended up in hospice, and she still ate heartily, and she hung in there for much longer than the medical experts would have anticipated. But after she passed away, it was right before the Oscars in 2003, and she, among others like Paul Sorvino, William Hurt, Anne Heche, Tom Sizemore, Robert Blake, to name a few, were omitted from the In Memoriam segment on the Oscars in favor of whatever today's diversity show has evolved into. And she was a lifelong Academy member. She, you know, I don't think, because she was honored with the SAG Awards, but I don't think, particularly when you're an Academy member for life, I don't think one should pick and choose whom one decides to memorialize or not, even if it's a rapid fire crawl. Everyone deserves their recognition, particularly if they've supported the Academy throughout a career. That, coupled with a few other factors, I started to research her early career. Obviously, our lives were inextricably intertwined, both when I was a child, obviously, and the divorce and custody battle she had with my father in Memphis, and the respective grandparents who were like the Capulets and the Montagues, but the hillbilly Capulets and the Montagues. And I started to look at her side of things. And, you know, as a child and a young adult, you know, I had my side of how my life went, but I started to look at things from her perspective. And I saw Patty Davis, who had written another book about her father, Ronald Reagan. And her first book was kind of a Daddy Dearest, a bit of a smear, and not that that truth wasn't necessarily her truth at the time, but she said, over time, I've been able to look at things through a softer lens and realize that my truth wasn't the whole truth, and that, and I felt that my mother's truth was worthy of having a look at. And particularly in today's fast food, internet, and social media society, someone who had the amazingly prolific career that she had and the longevity of a career that 99% of actors and actresses never dream of, she deserved some recognition.
Well, first of all, I want to tell you that I think it's appalling that a lifelong Academy member would be omitted from the In Memoriam segment at the Academy Awards, regardless of any concerns about diversity. That's number one. Number two, we had Patty Davis on our show, and she said on the show that she regretted writing that book, which I thought was quite fascinating, actually, that over the course of time, one can revisit one's initial impressions. So where and when can we see this documentary about your mom?
Well, interestingly, when we finished today, about an hour later, I start spotting with the post-production sound and video house. And I will have a finished picture in time to submit for Sundance by September 6th. My plan is to see if we can get into some significant film festivals and allow people to discover it. I have a backup plan to sell it to a particular distributor if that is not successful. But I want people to see it, and I want people to think about all of the relevant themes. The title "Stella Stevens, the Last Starlet" is in some ways reminiscent of Ethan Hawke's documentary on Paul Newman, which was Paul Newman, the last movie star. And my mother had this extraordinary Hollywood fairy tale discovery in modeling clothes in a department store in Memphis, Tennessee, which followed being discovered by a talent scout, sent to New York to take pictures, sent to LA to do a screen test, and getting put under contract to 20th Century Fox. And then she shortly thereafter was signed to Paramount when she auditioned and got Lil Abner, which was the Al Capp comic strip that was turned into a major Hollywood musical. And she recreated the role that Tina Louise had created on Broadway of Appassionata von Climax. And they promoted her as their new up-and-coming star. And there was a time when she was the most photographed woman in Hollywood. There was no social media, but the movie magazines were the social media of the day, and print press, and she was everywhere. So I think that we also deal with the male-dominated, misogynistic, last years of the golden age of Hollywood. And as Leonard Maltin says in the documentary, the town was full of earlier day Harvey Weinsteins. And I have some very interesting footage from Stella when she was on Rona Barrett's show, saying that she was often, if she attended a meeting unchaperoned, that people tried to rape her and she would have to fend them off, and how women were objectified. And then how things changed in the late 60s with the advent of movies like The Graduate, Easy Rider. Bonnie and Clyde was a significant change. And most significant was Midnight Cowboy, X-rated, won the Oscar. And so we deal with a lot of other themes, which I'll go into as we go along.
I can't wait to see that movie, and I hope you'll come back when it's been released for public viewing so that we can help you promote it, because I can't wait.
I'd love to. Thank you.
You appeared with your mom in four movies, Las Vegas Lady, Down the Drain, The Terror Within 2, and Illicit Dreams. What was she like to work with?
Well, Las Vegas Lady was shortly after I moved from Memphis, after I graduated high school, back to Los Angeles and embarked on an acting career, which is a whole other story. And it was a movie that my mother was doing in Las Vegas. I went up to visit and the producer said, hey, we got this role. Why didn't you do the role? I said, okay. Later, as my career sort of took off, and particularly when I started producing films, I was able to hire my mother. So Down the Drain, I was still predominantly working as an actor at the time, and the producer was a friend of mine, and I suggested her for a role, as I did in an episode of The Oregon Trail, which was a TV series that I was doing for Universal and probably a few other shows. And he said, oh, I'd love to have her. But then, as you know, and one thing I touch on in the documentary is that over 35, over 40, over 45-year-old actresses in Hollywood didn't have the career lifespan that actresses do today. There was no streaming. You know, there was only movies and television, and then the advent in the mid-80s of recordable home video formats emerged. And then we had this whole tertiary market from which to either recycle product for archival purposes, you know, where you could buy Sunset Boulevard on a VHS and put it on your bookshelf. But direct-to-home video movie stars emerged, and it became a very, very viable platform for a number of years until DVD took over, and then streaming took over from DVD. So I hired my mother, I believe, 11 times once I started producing and owning my own companies, and, you know, tried to, I don't want to say help her, but give her work, because she loved to work. And she was a very hard worker, and it was really a part of her fabric and her self-esteem to work.
You have literally mastered every aspect of the entertainment business, both in front of and behind the camera, and in the arena of corporate leadership, labor relations, sales, distribution, finance, publicity, marketing, so much more. But you started out as an actor. In fact, I read that you auditioned for the role of Luke Skywalker in Star Wars. Is that true?
It's obliquely true. I was sent an audition to show up to meet two unknown directors, Brian De Palma and George Lucas, and they were jointly seeing young actors and actresses for their two movies. One was called Carrie, that I was very interested in, and one was called Star Wars, that I didn't really quite understand. And for whatever reason, the audition scene that I was given for the two of them wasn't a scene from Carrie. It was a scene from Star Wars, I believe. And I clearly was not very connected with it because I didn't quite understand the material. And with Carrie, although Brian De Palma and I had much more of a simpatico in the meeting, He cast actors that were significantly older than me. At the time, I was actually high school age, and he cast actors about 5, 6, 7 years older to play high school age. So I was clearly too young to be in the running for that movie, but it laid the groundwork for his movie, The Fury, which came up a few years later, and I was able to do this fabulous film with Brian De Palma and work with Kirk Douglas and John Cassavetes.
You got a bachelor's degree in psychology. Has that helped you in your work?
I'm not sure if it's helped me in my work. Perhaps it's helped me understand women. I'm joking, but I think it's a good foundation, particularly for an actor if one is preparing a role, or for a producer if one is dealing with actors, and particularly with star actors, each of which bring their own basket of goods to the table.
That's very diplomatic.
Thank you.
You co-starred with Charles Bronson in two films, Death Hunt and 10 to Midnight. What was he like to work with?
Death Hunt was the first picture that I did with Charles Bronson and Lee Marvin. And Bronson was very much an isolationist. He surrounded himself with his family and a couple of their employees. He didn't socialize. He didn't integrate with the rest of the cast or the rest of the crew. And Lee Marvin, on the other hand, and we spent 3 months in Calgary and Banff, Alberta, Canada. Lee was gregarious and warm and embracing, and he glommed on to me and Carl Weathers as part of his posse. And we would eat and drink and carouse, even though Carl was one of the fittest men I knew at the time. But so we were on the diametrically opposed from Charlie's camp. And then a few years later, when 10 to Midnight came around, Charlie and I had a foundational relationship from Death Hunt, and he approved me for the co-lead in the movie as his young detective partner. And we had a much, I think, a much broader relationship that we never got to explore in Death Hunt. And I have a great Charles Bronson story, which I could tell if we had the time.
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to hear it.
So if you came up to Charlie and you said, "Hey, Charlie, tell me about Once Upon a Time in the West. Tell me about de-" He would say, "Move away." He didn't want people after him or to pull things from him. And so I never pursued him with any sort of conversation. But going back to perhaps this has something to do with the psychology degree. One morning we were lighting a car that Charlie and I were to sit in. I was in the driver's seat. He was to be in the passenger seat. And we were across the street from a house that we were staking out. I'd been to make up and I had Kleenex in my collar, had a cup of coffee, and I had my LA Times. And I was standing around and there were stand-ins sitting in the car. And I knocked on the window of the stand-in and I said, "Let me sit in." And he said, "Are you sure?" I said, "Yeah, I'm sure. I'm freezing." So I sat in, I started reading my paper, drinking my coffee. I saw Charlie out there kind of going like this. And finally, he opens the door, his stand-in gets out, and Charlie sits down. I look at him and I nod. I don't say a word. He sits there, he sits there, he sits there, no perceived threat. He starts to suck his teeth. Finally, he looks at me and says, "Good morning, Andrew." I said, "Hey, Charlie." I turn the page of my LA Times. Little by little, he started asking me questions. He came to me. It was like, a stray dog that doesn't want to come get the food. He came to me, and when he felt he was approaching me, I got him talking about Sergio Leone. He said, when we did Once Upon a Time in the West, Leone, he said he had music for each character, and he'd play the music before he'd start the scene, and then he'd say, "Action." He said, "That's acting." And he told me about working in the coal mines in Pennsylvania. He told me about the first stage appearance he had, where he played a blacksmith, and he said, "I felt so powerful." And he shared things And I wrote a foreword on a book about Charles Bronson. I recounted this story, and he shared things that I don't believe he shared with a lot of people, but significantly because he didn't feel like somebody was trying to get something from him.
See, that's where your psychology came in.
Exactly.
Well, now, of course, I have to ask you about Fury. I hope you're not going to tell me to move away, but it struck me when I saw Fury that you turned a corner in your career in terms of the intensity of your delivery as an actor. Did it feel that way to you?
I was really young. I think I was 21, maybe about to turn 22. I was shooting a TV series for NBC Universal called The Oregon Trail in Flagstaff, Arizona, and I was under contract to the studio. I was one of the last contract players at Universal. And I got an offer to do this film, and the schedules conflicted, and I begged the studio to try and work it out. So I would go work some days all day in Flagstaff, Arizona, in a cowboy costume on a horse, jump on a plane and fly to LA or Chicago and be on set the next morning shooting The Fury. And then finally got off a couple of weeks when we finished up shooting in Israel. We had a whole sequence in Caesarea, Israel. And I've got a glorious Cassavetti story that I'll tell you. We had just wrapped in Israel, and Cassavetes was there with his wife, Jenna Rollins. And he says, "Hey, kid, where are you going after this?" I said, "I guess home." And he said, "What do you got to be home? What for?" I said, "Nothing. I guess I just, you know, I guess I'm," but he said, "Ah, nah, you come with me and Gina." So they took me with them to Rome, and we checked into the Excelsior Hotel. We had fabulous dinners. We shopped for shoes for Gina. And then we all flew home together. But, you know, possibly because of my relationship with him that it evolved during filming, and possibly because he had directed my mother in one of his first films, Too Late Blues with Bobby Darin, he really took care of me and took me under his wing. So it was very, very sweet. But back to The Fury, I don't know. I certainly didn't know at the time that anything significant was going on with me as an actor, except that I was running ragged, playing two characters that were very different. But there was an intensity that De Palma imposed on the role, because when he hired me, I didn't realize that he intended to put prosthetics on my forehead and pulsing and throbbing veins. And I had the dream team of makeup artists. The preeminent special effects makeup artist in the business was a guy named Dick Smith. And he had a young protege named Rick Baker, who of course did all the makeup on Michael Jackson's Thriller. And then the straight makeup artist was a guy named William Tuttle, who had worked on so many Hollywood movies, but he won the Oscar for The Seven Faces of Dr. Lau. And he was one of the only makeup artists in Hollywood, because it wasn't a regular yearly award that had won an Oscar. So I realized that, you know, Brian was going to have these gradient degrees of this character becoming more and more unhinged. And Dick Smith created the appliances, Rick Baker applied them, and Bill Tuttle made them up. And I told that story at the Tom Savini School of Special Effects Makeup to a rapt audience with all these students' heroes.
What an amazing film that was. Now, of course, Andrew, I have to ask you about Dallas. You played Casey Deneau for two seasons on Dallas. Was that an enjoyable experience for you?
It was a very enjoyable experience. The genesis was that I had decided that I didn't want to be an actor anymore. And I was trying to figure out how I could pay the mortgage and still scale down my acting career and try to pole vault into writing and directing and producing. And out of the blue, I got offered this 2-year contract role on this series that had been on the air forever that had, you know, probably 20 or 30 regular characters. So if you had three scenes in an episode, that was a lot because they had so many storylines going on. One scene maybe in JR's office, two scenes maybe, you know, on an exterior street or by a hotel swimming pool. And then I had the rest of the time off. So I I didn't think it was a career move at the time. I thought it would have been seen as a very negative career move by the industry, not by the fans, certainly, and not by the public. But because I'd always done my own shows, and this was clearly not my show, I was just a cog in of many. And it was a delightful experience. I live in Dallas, Texas now, based on relationships with lifelong friends that I made when I was there filming. And I had the greatest of times and was able to make enough money to allow me to pursue the other things that right after Dallas, I basically quit acting as my primary vocation.
I find that so interesting because I read something that you said about acting in an interview you gave a number of years ago. I'm going to quote it to you here. You said, "It's an unfortunate fact of life that some of the most interesting and challenging roles are the most villainous. There's just so much more to work with when the character is the heavy. The audience develops really strong feelings about him right away." So I have to ask you, given that, and given your desire to get out of acting, can I assume that you did not enjoy most of the roles that you played?
No. Acting careers are, they all have an arc. And they start, you know, it's like a bell curve. And they peak, and then they start downward. Sometimes, like a Sally Field, there's a resurgence, and you become a bigger star with more depth and breadth than anyone ever gave you credit for. But those are exceedingly rare. And I had been, in my mind, relegated to doing roles that didn't feed me, that I was doing to pay the mortgage, to pay the car payments, to go on vacations. And it's very difficult. It's easy when you're 18, 19, 20, 21 years old, and you live very frugally with not a lot of frills. But when you start to make a little money, you want to be a homeowner, you want to buy a house, you want a nice car. And once you have financial responsibilities, you got to earn to be able to do that. And then art goes out the window and commerce sets in, and you can't really, it's very difficult, I won't say can't, to have an artistic career when you have a fiduciary responsibility to yourself and others, and when you're motivated by money. So I became disillusioned. And you know, I don't direct a lot because I started becoming disillusioned with directing as well. And I said, I don't want to fall out of love with it also. So I just backed off. But, you know, it's funny, over time, it's kind of hearkening back to what we said about my mother and Patty Davis with Ronald Reagan. I've become less and less strident about, don't call me an actor. You know, I would do a cameo, you know, once or twice a year for friends, or step in if it was a movie that I was producing, you know, just for fun. But I also had this negative connotation, because in today's fast food mentality of media, there's very little historical context, and people don't know that actors historically were considered the dregs of society. There were, you know, they were lower than the Irish. If someone in polite society said, "Oh, but darling, I have an actor coming to dinner." "Oh, an actor, you know, because they were ne'er-do-wells. They had no money. And like LA Country Club, for years, up until Randolph Scott, when he was the poster child for World War II, Their membership was no Blacks, no Jews, and no actors. Actors were never considered well-to-do or financially stable or politically correct in polite society. So I was always a little disillusioned by that as well.
And what about you as a writer? You've written screenplays for over a dozen movies and TV shows. What would you say drives your creativity as a writer, Andrew?
I write almost every day, and I have a bunch of screenplays that I've written that I haven't made yet. In fact, I'm making one in September. But I don't know. I think that there are ideas that I have, the execution of which at times is easier to do myself than impart to another writer who may or may not get it right. And it depends on how much time I have. If I'm not on a project and I have free time, I work every day. And if it's writing or budgeting or scheduling, but you know, it's just part of the creative process.
But it's fascinating to me that you don't write with you in mind, because you're not focused on being an actor primarily. So you just write focused on the story and character development, not thinking of yourself.
We as independent producers, we have been excluded by the monopolies of the seven conglomerates that the federal government has looked the other way and not acknowledged that they have killed the small business of the independent film industry, and that they have violated anti-trade regulations by allowing these six or seven conglomerates to own every media outlet and worldwide. There used to be a mandate for independence. It expired. It's gone. In the late 40s, early 50s, there was a deregulation called FinCEN, and the federal government deregulated studios and made them divest from owning cinemas. Because if Fox Studios bought Lowe's Cinema, they could create their own product, distribute it, and blockbook to the films in their own cinemas, and they created a monopoly. Well, what's going on today is 1,000 times more onerous. And you mentioned the Independent Film and Television Alliance, and I was on the board for 10 years. Our lobbying budget for Washington was $500,000 a year. Well, for the big boys, that's lunch. So, you know, I wish that there were someone in Washington who was cognizant enough to give the small business owners of the independent filmmakers some sort of quarter. Not a big one, just a small one.
Amen to that. You know, everyone I know who works in the film and television industry tells me that it's brutal in terms of the financing, the personalities involved, the competition, the betrayals, the disappointments. It makes me wonder, what is it about producing movies that motivates and excites you so much?
Well, to dovetail in what you're asking about what I write for what I can sell. So there's a very narrow margin of crumbs that are left for the independents, and they're generally genre pictures. I just finished a movie with Al Pacino a couple of months ago, which is based on a true story of the last Vatican-sanctioned exorcism that took place on American soil in 1928. And Pacino plays a Capuchin priest who comes to a small town in Ohio to work with a younger priest to help this afflicted woman whose medical doctors have failed and the burgeoning pseudoscience of psychiatry has failed, and she has turned to faith. So there's a lot of faith versus science, you know, the old ways versus the new ways. And it's a much more interesting piece than, you know, a straight jump scare exorcism movie. It's very much a character piece, and the supernatural elements are well documented and historical.
So that motivates you when you get a project that's got a story that you feel is compelling with a team around you, including the actors, who are commercial and successful and relatable. Now, that makes sense. It's just that with the hundreds of channels and streaming platforms out there, the public has so much choice in what they choose to watch. So how important has it become to you in recent years to advertise and publicize the movies and the TV shows that you make?
Not at all, really, because the way my current business model works, unlike my previous business models when I was in the foreign sales and distribution business, I pre-sell the product. So the product being the film. The genre is important and the star cast is critical. So the right genre with the right couple of actors, and you always need a couple, are critical to then pre-selling to one of the few remaining distributors that acquire independent films. And sometimes it might be a worldwide distributor, sometimes it might be a foreign sales or distribution company for a component of the financing, and then a domestic company, which collectively coupled with a tax credit or a rebate in a state that offers film incentives, makes up the collective strike price or the production budget of the picture. Then the trick is, okay, I just have contracts. How do I monetize the contracts? So that's a whole nother element.
Do you think the public's taste in movies has changed over the years?
You know, I've got twin 21-year-old girls, and you know, very friendly with all their friends and school colleagues, and they're all watching Love Island on Peacock. So very few of the younger generations are watching the types of movies that we make. My son's 27. He watches anime, you know, more so than the movies we make. And he often works with me in the film business. So rarely does he, you know, he'll watch maybe one time a cut of a film, you know, that we've done.
You know, when I think of TV shows, it makes me wonder nowadays, do you think the public has the attention span that it used to have to give a show a chance before switching to something else?
Yes and no. I think that whole, you know, 10-minute blurb of attention span that Jeffrey Katzenberg tried it, and it flopped big time. So that was the conditional yes, but that's what kids get on their phones all day. What I think has also risen to the top is long form television. You know, like my girls were obsessed with Pretty Little Liars. Even Love Island, if it was one episode, they wouldn't have the ongoing fervor that they all do, because having 30 episodes, they get to follow the whole arc and evolution of all these characters that they've come to know and love. So I think longer form is really the future wave, because people want to be entertained for longer periods of time and binge watch, I believe.
That's definitely my experience too. Binge watching is what it's all about. So Andrew, when you're involved in the making of a feature film, are you able to tell if the movie will be a big hit?
No. No. There are always anomalies. And sometimes films that I may not think are the best representation of what attracted me to the material or the screenplay. I did a picture with Morgan Freeman and Cole Hauser a couple of years ago called The Minute You Wake Up Dead. And Grindstone, a division of Lionsgate, was the domestic distributor, and we had a 30 major market theatrical release, and then the picture came out, and it's been one of their biggest sellers. And, you know, people thought the picture was okay when we delivered it. They thought it missed the mark in some areas, and yet it was tremendously successful.
So go figure. So how important is it for a film to win awards like film festival awards or Oscars or Golden Globes in order for a movie to be financially successful?
I've never found that to be a factor, because even when I had my big company and I had an output deal with Warner Brothers, the film was already monetized. And the P&A, the prints and advertising money, was being put up by Warner Brothers. So that machine was already underway, and they were doing what they do best. I had already sold the film in all foreign territories worldwide outside of North America, and basically minimum guarantees on movies. Pretty much it's all one ever counts on. Very rarely are you going to see any significant overage or true accounting on a movie anywhere, much less in the international market. So I had, the pledge was in the main competition in Cannes. It was a movie that Sean Penn directed with Jack Nicholson and Robin Wright Penn and a magnificent cast. I had a picture in Director's Fortnight, a picture in Un Certain Regard, others in Toronto, and, four pictures in Sundance. So I don't think that it really matters so much to the independent filmmaker, but it matters to the studio, because if they own the product and their machine can exploit an Oscar nomination or a Golden Globe nomination or multiple nominations, then that's a much bigger deal for the big boys.
But during the golden age of Hollywood and the studio system, the studio executives like Louis B. Mayer, Irving Thalberg, Jack Warner, Daryl F. Zanuck, they loved movies. They really loved them, and they had a lot of creative control. But now I get the impression that the people who make creative decisions at the big studios have financial training, but no real artistic experience or creative talent in filmmaking. Is that a good thing?
I don't think it's a good thing. And I think everything is compartmentalized. I think studios are like an auto assembly line, and everybody knows how to put the set screw in the rearview mirror or fit the console and, in between the front seats. I don't think anybody knows how to make the whole car. And that's the difference between people who work at studios and or streamers that act as studios, as opposed to independent filmmakers who risk their own livelihoods and not only have to know how to make the entire car, but have to know where that car is going once it leaves the assembly line, what freighter it's going on, what dealership it's landing in what foreign territory, and then service every end user around the world. And to even precede it getting on the assembly line, be integrally involved in all the research and development to get it into production.
So, Andrew, every filmmaker we've had on this show has told me that getting financing to make a movie is the toughest part of the project. So I want to ask you, if you were a person with a couple of million dollars to invest and you were asked by a filmmaker to invest in a movie, what would be the factors you would consider in deciding whether to take that risk of investing in their film?
Just like a bank loan, collateral. So what's the collateral? If part of a tax credit or a rebate film incentive is part of that collateral, and one feels confident with the estimate from the state, that's very tangible collateral. I actually personally loan against film incentive rebates in a particular state. Who is the domestic distributor? Is there a presale? And is it is it Saban? Is it Lionsgate? Is it, is it Universal? And is that contract with a solvent, major or mini major company that I feel confident, on acceptance of delivery, that contract's going to be paid. Sometimes if there's a gap, then the foreign market, sometimes you can pre-sell the entire foreign market. Sometimes you can pre-sell a few territories, and sometimes you can leave foreign open. And that can be, either break even and or perceived profit.
Well, I want to mention to our viewers, many of whom are filmmakers, you have a very popular film school series comprised of 8 DVDs, which teaches every aspect of filmmaking. Does it inspire you to be an educator, to be a role model, and to share your expertise and your knowledge?
You know, when I embark on certain things, it's sometimes a knee-jerk reaction to something else that may be in the marketplace. And I found that so many people who were, touting film schools, they were teaching theory. And I learn by doing, and what I teach is the very pragmatic soup to nuts of how the business really works. Because most people who teach have never done it. And most people who teach don't really understand the business. Most people who are in the business understand their assembly line position in the business, but they don't understand how the whole business really works, particularly actors and crew members. You know, very few people understand how the entire global film industry, this import-export product that we make called film, actually works and actually functions. So I try to demystify it for people. And my DVD series or on download series, it was made a long time ago. The fundamentals are still the same and still apply. It's just that the technology and media has advanced.
Well, what I love about that is that people who may not be able to afford to go to school full time can benefit from your expertise and be educated either with the DVDs or online by downloading. It makes it very accessible. And I think that we want to cultivate talent and we want to make the education available. And another thing I have to mention, you're too humble to mention this, but I'm going to. On top of everything else you've done, you've found the time to do volunteer work helping elderly patients with dementia, which is a subject that you know only too well because of your dear mom. And it's a very commendable thing for you to do, Andrew. I want to publicly acknowledge your generosity as a human being.
That's very sweet. Well, my mother's mother, I lived 17 and a half years in Memphis, and I lived about 6 years with my mother from 6 to 12, but from 1 to 6 and 12 to 18, almost, I lived with my grandparents. And my mother's mother, as well as my father's mother, they were the ones who predominantly raised me. And my mother's mother, sister, my mother's great aunt, had very early onset dementia and then Alzheimer's. And my mother's mother started experiencing a cognitive decline after her husband died. And we went to an attorney. I became her durable and actual power of attorney for everything in her life, sold her house and moved her out. And she lived with me and my wife at the time in Los Angeles for a number of years until she declined significantly. And then she went into a care facility that specialized in memory care because we had a baby and it just became unsafe. But I've had vast personal experience, and it's an insidious disease. But one can only have compassion, and particularly for a loved one who, to me, it's just giving back everything that she gave me as a child.
Well, I don't think there's a family that I've ever known that wasn't affected in some capacity by someone suffering from dementia and or Alzheimer's. And I think that the fact that you do find the time to make a difference for people who are dealing with that is incredibly generous of you and very inspirational. I want to tell you, Andrea, it's been such a pleasure meeting you and having this chance to learn more about your career and especially your insights on the entertainment industry and also the efforts that you're making to educate the next generation of filmmakers. Thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our show.
Harvey, thank you so much for having me. And once the documentary is out there and you've had a chance to see it, I'd love to send you a link, have you have a look at it, and then we can chat again.
I would love that. Our guest has been the brilliant actor, writer, director, producer, author extraordinaire, Andrew Stevens. For more information about Andrew Stevens and his books and educational programs, please visit his official website, andrewstevens.info. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my managers, Rick Marcelli and Robin Bragg Marcelli at the Marcelli Company in Hollywood, my director of programming, Robert Monaghan, my PR directors, Eileen Shapiro and Jimmy Starr, and my entire team at the XPTV One Network in the UK.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.